Welcome back, everybody, to episode 4 of Misspent Matinee with Blaine and Chris. I am Blaine, and it is the most wonderful time of the year. It's no longer hot as fuck. The leaves are starting to turn, and it is all horror movies all the time. That's right, all of you ghouls and ghosts. It is finally Halloween, but before we get to all that jazz, hey, Chris, how's it been, man?
Hey, well, it's definitely been interesting last couple of weeks. You know, for all the listeners out there, I just had another little baby, a boy, and he's doing great. His name's Jack. He is insistent on not allowing me or Robin to sleep, and so I'm walking around like a zombie, which is apropos of the season. And you know, it's really a joy to have another little baby in the house, and the kids have the other boys, obviously Mac and Soren, have been so excited and so helpful and fascinated, really, by just the whole process of a baby. So it's been a really interesting couple of weeks, that's for sure.
Oh, that's awesome, man. So I take it with having the baby at home, you haven't been getting in a whole lot of watching for this Halloween season so far?
Well, we've actually been doing okay because we can't do much except sit on the couch. And, you know, while Robin's nursing the baby, we've been putting on a lot of TV shows. We certainly haven't been out to the theater in a while. Actually, the last movie that I saw in the theater was It with you, which is what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, very, very cool. Absolutely, man. With that said, I mean, have you been watching anyone? Do you ever do like a like 31 days of horror sort of thing for October, or anything at least spooky lately?
Yes. So we finished recently the new show on Netflix, Mindhunter. And I think you've watched that as well. I love everything David Fincher, everything, except maybe Benjamin Button. But it's you know, it really is a show for any of you guys out there that haven't seen it. I recommend it. It's a fascinating look into the psychology of serial killers and the creation of the science of profiling serial killers by the FBI. And there's just so many great parts of the show, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah, no, I got a chance to watch through the series, and I was not expecting it to be much because I'm not a big fan of police procedural kind of stuff. But once I saw that David Fincher was involved, I kind of, you know, got into those first like 3 or 4 episodes. I was pretty well on board. Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, I've been actually trying to do the 31 movies for Halloween this year, and trying to watch one a day, and I'm totally behind. I'm probably behind about 7 or 8 days already. But I did get a chance to check out some new stuff that was a lot of fun. That's all brand new. One that I saw was recently the Mick G directed straight to Netflix movie The Babysitter, which was a lot of fun. And I've never been a fan of Mick G. He's a director that I kind of despise usually. I don't know. His style is always kind of, you know, it always feels kind of like old MTV ad sort of stuff. But I was blown away. The Babysitter, it's kind of, it's goofy. It's definitely, you can see the Mick G influence in it, but they kind of flip it on its head, and it turns out to be kind of a fun thing to just like watch something that's mindless but kind of clever during the Halloween season, just to kind of get you in the mood for it. So I enjoyed that, but also been making my way through a lot of kind of, you know, the movies that I always watch, movies like Satan's Little Helper and Tales of Halloween, and just trying to finally get the vibe, man. Because I don't know about you, have you been slow to, like, between the baby being born and work and it being like 100 degrees, you know, over the past few weeks, had a hard time like remembering that it's almost time for Halloween?
Yeah, well, we just got the change in season, right? It was it was about 85 degrees right up until about a week and a half ago, right before the baby was born. Robin just reminded me, I can't believe I forgot this. One movie we did get to see on the day before Jack came into the world was Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Robin and I had a little date, and some of our family members were in town, and they watched the boys, and we got to go out and see Blade Runner, and that... I can't believe I forgot to mention that. That is an astounding movie. I I can't get over how much I liked it. I'm such a big fan of the original. I was a little hesitant going in with my enthusiasm because it had such big shoes to fill. You know, obviously, Denis Villeneuve, I think that's how you say his name. I'm a big fan of his. He's on a historical run of movies right now. So I trusted that he was going to bring something cool to the table, but it exceeded my expectations. I absolutely loved it.
No, that is a movie that I saw, right about the same time. So I'm going to save my opinion. I'm not going to blow my load too soon, but wait till that could be one of our upcoming episodes, but we'll get back to that towards the end of, back towards the end of all this. But yeah, with that said, I couldn't be happier to hear it, and I cannot wait to be able to go hold that chubby cheek little baby again here soon. But if you're new to our show, we are a podcast that discusses film and family from our own perspective. Chris is my ex-wife's new husband, and we are blessed to all make it work. While we talk movies and mayhem, we hope to give you a little window also into our weird little strange but functional world. Wouldn't you say, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. We're definitely the modern family. It really is a blessing to all be able to do what we do. I think the boys are the reason why we all kind of have come together, and then that's how it started. But then, once we started hanging out for the boys, we found out that we had such a big interest in common, which is our love of movies, our love of how movies have formed our psychology growing up and has informed the way we see the world. And then of course we started doing this podcast because we just, every time we got together, all we did was talk about movies.
No, absolutely. And that's something that's so awesome about this form of podcast. It's something that you and I, we could take a break from the day to day, no work, no chasing kids, and just sit down and you and I be able to kind of bond over this mutual love and kind of obsession with movies. So, with that said, Chris, tell them what movie we're going to be talking about this week and what our top five is going to be as well.
Right. So this week, because it's Halloween and we're just a couple of days away, we're recording this on Saturday before Halloween. We decided that it would be just an obvious decision to talk about horror movies, and in particular, to talk about It. And we together went to see It about a month ago, I guess. And both of us were just floored by how good it was. I was giddy walking out of the theater. I was just so excited that they finally did it. Adaptation that was the TV show, I think it looms larger in the public consciousness, as an event or as something as a reference point than it really does as it really doesn't hold up as entertainment. I went back and watched it recently, and there's just so many cringe-worthy lines and scenes and I was really, really happy that the new iteration was just so well done. I mean, it's one of the best movies of the year and one of the best movies I've seen in that genre in a long time.
No, absolutely. And it's such a surprise because, like you said, that original miniseries, it's not as much a great movie as much as it was such a part of our generations growing up, that kind of that window from, people born between like 1977 and 1985, where we remember when that came on TV and that just like burned its way into like every little kid's psyche. It was everything that you were scared of. And I remember when we were kids, after we saw it, we used to play in all these kind of like washout drains and stuff over my house. And we literally, it went from being like, hey, let's go play in the tunnels to, hey, let's go play in the tunnels and try to find it. Just because it was that exact thing that you would find when you were that age of riding around your bikes, going on adventures. And it was like, oh my God, here's this terrifying story about a demon clown that pertains to me and like my actual day-to-day life, which is always, I think, is such an interesting thing about the movie. It is just, it's so central to kind of the fear that, kind of this whole you know, micro generation grew up with. But I mean, but we're talking about it. I mean, the new film, which was you know, directed by Andreas Muschietti, which I'm sure I said that incredibly wrong.
I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly how you pronounce it. That's right.
All right. Well, yeah, this film, it takes place again in the town of Derry, just like both the book and the miniseries. And the local kids are basically disappearing one by one, leaving behind bloody remains in a place known as the Barrens. A group of seven kids, they're united by their horrifying and strange encounters with an evil clown and their determination as a group to go in there and kill it. So Chris, I mean, I know you said that you liked it, but I mean, what were a few of the things that like really kind of elevated this from like being like, oh, that's a good horror movie, to be like, okay, this is something that like could be in my top 10 this year?
Well, you know, I think we got to start with Skarsgård's portrayal of Pennywise. It is just absolutely like skin crawling and creepy and just, it's not over the top like Tim Curry's Pennywise was. It's just much scarier to me. There are certain scenes. I mean, that first scene when he's in the drain and the way that he's talking, and then he starts to kind of lose control because of his excitement, and he starts, you know, drooling all over himself and leaning in, and it's just a frightening portrayal. And a great job by Skarsgård. I think his first name's Bill, by the way, since there's a lot of Skarsgårds now out in Hollywood.
Right.
So it really that portrayal of Pennywise, and then as you go forward and the various forms that he takes for the kids, every single one of them is nightmare-inducing. It's like it hits you on a subconscious level. You know, the scary flute player is like, I get chills every time I think about that, the scary flute player coming in off the painting and going after what's his name, the young Jewish kid. And another thing that's funny about this movie is that all the kids are kind of playing parts, and that's generally what Stephen King books and stories are like, that everyone's just kind of a stereotype. So there is, you know, the sick kid, the Jewish kid, the black kid, the smart ass, the one that's got everything together, but he's got a stutter, and then the girl.
Right.
Oh yeah. And the bookish kid that does all the research into the town. And I thought that the performances by the kids in this movie are top notch across the board. But everyone was incredibly believable and natural in these roles.
Yeah, and I think that was a lot of that came from having a script, you know, originally written by that guy who, Cary Fukunaga, who did the first season of True Detective and a few other rewrites, where I feel like they kind of took like those archetypal roles and gave them a little bit more life. And it helped that they actually found a group of kids that not only were likable, but were relatively good actors. And I mean, they're almost, to me, in my opinion, they're almost cheating with someone like Flynn Wolfhard, the kid from Stranger Things. I mean, they just feel so, they feel just so much like people you grew up with and how you sound. I mean, like, I love the way that they like, how they like try to swear and they can't quite get, you know, profanity right. Cause you're a kid. You're just like, I don't know. I just want to say shit a bunch of times. And like, so it just kind of made me enjoy that. And I mean, I loved Bill Skarsgård, his whole role with playing Pennywise the clown, because I mean, I think it'd be really easy for someone to kind of fall into, you know, kind of mimicking Tim Curry and going that route. But I felt like, man, he really brought something like a little bit more like otherworldly and sinister to it, especially like you were talking about in the drain scene with Georgie, the little brother who dies. When he goes silent and like stops moving, that is like one of the scariest things, because it just, on top of being strange and unsettling to look at, it's terrifying for something like that, you know, basically this fucking clown demon to go completely silent and motionless. And you see that, those kind of moments throughout the film, where the movie kind of lets scenes breathe. I don't feel like we're, you know, just sprinting through this story. I feel like those kind of scenes, they let it get a little bit longer. They let those takes feel a little uncomfortable because it builds up so much of the tension around the film.
That's right. And, you know, I think you said it great. Bill Skarsgård's performance, you know, the danger of this kind of thing would be to try to out Tim Curry and fall into camp as opposed to what really comes across as an otherworldly demon who's mimicking a facsimile of human speech and human emotion, trying to lure the children into his trap. And when he breaks that character and gets overly excited about the impending kill, and then, you know, to start the movie with a kid getting his arm eaten off, you know, I mean, you really know that this is going to be a no punches pulled type of story from the very beginning. And the scenes, every single set piece you know, nothing seems rushed. Nothing seems like it's just thrown in there for no reason. Everything really does breathe and creates this atmosphere of tension and fright.
Oh, yeah. And you brought up a good point. I forgot to mention this before, like how R-rated this movie was, because I was not expecting to see the kind of like child violence and kind of, you know, they call it like kinder trauma throughout the film. I mean, I kind of love this about this movie, because you know this is going to become one of those movies that's like a rite of passage on, you know, when you go stay the night at your buddy's house, you know, where everyone watches and tries to get through. And just seeing that scene where not only is Georgie killed, his arm is brutally ripped off of him, and you watch this kid suffer, and it's like, it's pretty effective, man. I mean, I know it's going to play on us, you know, being parents with little boys and stuff, and it's sad, but oh my God, that kid they picked to use Georgie, like, it just seems so cruel during his death, but it kind of set the tone, like, okay, we know that the gloves are off. Any of these kids can die at any moment. Anybody can get it, and that's such a great thing about a lot of these new horror films that are coming out, where they're not following those rules. They're rolling the dice on these R-rated vehicles with a couple bucks behind them, and you really have no idea, like, are the little kids safe? Are we going to kill them? You know, what kind of danger are they going to be in? So, yeah, and I was going to ask you, because, you know, this is the first, like, major film from Andreas Muscati, but did you see his other film he did a few years back, Mama? Yeah.
No, I haven't. I've read a lot about it, actually. Once this movie came out, I went back and I read some reviews about Mama. And it's, you know, I would like to see. I haven't had the opportunity just yet.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that I saw. It's nothing like fantastic. It's not like, oh man, you gotta go see this. But it is an interesting movie because he took a lot of what I think works about Mama in these scenes of just kind of silence and like tension building, but got it better, because the problem with Mama was that the big bad in that movie is just like just awful CGI. It's really ugly to look at, and it gets a little bit laughable, but it has that kind of fairy tale kind of vibe that you see carry on in it as well. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I also really love kind of the whole genre of like kids on bike movies. I mean, maybe that's from growing up in the Amblin era, but I felt like this was like a great addition to the, you know, kind of the long tradition of, you know, kids going on adventures on bikes.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. E.T., Goonies, a movie that we'll talk about briefly coming up, Stand By Me. You know, all of those movies, you know, I saw them while I was myself a kid on a bike, going through the neighborhood and imagining different scenarios like it, you know, or like, you know, like the Goonies trying to go on a treasure hunt and finding, you know, these booby traps and that kind of thing. I feel the same way. And I think this is it's in the top five for me of kids on bikes. I mean, just I don't know if I'd be able to put together like a list right now, but it's right up there. And I do want to point out, you did talk about Finn Wolfhard's performance as Richie. But it really stands out. The by far the most reaction in the theater from the audience was every time he opened his mouth to say anything. You just heard just a tremendous reaction from the crowd. People cracking up and laughing and like really hanging on everything he's gonna say. Just a great performance.
Oh yeah, no, that's the one thing that even a few weeks after. That still sticks with me is just every single joke he rattled off was it lands, man. He nails it because he is a little kid and he probably doesn't know about half the shit he's saying anyways. So that's what makes it so funny because, it's like they're trying to talk about, like sex and women and all that stuff. It's like you're like a 12-year-old kid. All he knows is like just like vulgar, like just vulgarities. And it's so much fun to see it.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, and it isn't. I'm not sure the kid's name, but the kid who plays Bill, Georgie's big brother, man. At first I thought, oh man, he may not be like the guy that's gonna carry this movie, but man, I thought he did a good job of like coming across as kind of that one friend in the group that even when your kids has like a goal and plans. Like I don't know, I really thought that he did a good job of kind of falling into that, that character.
Right. He's the cornerstone of the group. He's, the person on which everyone relies. He's just got this strength of character, a singularity of purpose. He really is. And the actor's name, I may be just completely butchering it, but I think it's Jaden Laborer. And he does a great job. I think such, and all the way down the list, I really like the character Ben, the kind of chubby, bookish historian of all of the murders in the town. I really thought he did great. I thought Sophie Lillis was awesome as Beverly, just really in a kind of a tough role too, because her story, her backstory is really dark and really troubling. And for her to like be able to kind of keep it all together. And really let that kind of steeliness and her strength kind of shine through. I thought she did great. Just what a wonderful first performance from an actor.
Oh yeah, no, she definitely. I mean, she probably has kind of the juiciest parts of a lot of the movie. And getting her kind of her own scenes and her own side story. That's pretty compelling. Ends up playing a major role in the story because I don't want to ruin anything, even though, this movie did what, like, nearly $700 million, so I'm sure you've already seen it. But either way, man, I know we've been saying a lot of good stuff, but I did kind of want to chime in, especially while we're talking about the young cast and some of the stuff that once I got a little bit away from kind of bugged me was I really didn't like the bullies like as actors.
That's a classic Stephen King.
Yeah. Oh, it's got. Trope, yeah.
Right. It's over the top bullying, where it's psychopathic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think I know it had to be in there. It's part of the story. It creates a lot of the momentum from in between the Pennywise scenes. And I know that it's kind of necessary if you're going to do the adaptation, but. I'm just over these like psychopathic, like cardboard cutout bullies that are just completely unrealistic. Like no one's ever been like that.
Yeah, I mean these are because in all of his movies, that being Stephen King, and this is what we'll talk about more as we get into our top five. But in some of these adaptations, there has to be a point where writers say, you know what, we're stepping away. We're not going to be worried about Stephen King getting mad about the adaptation. These are adaptations. They don't have to follow on. So when you have like these like absolute sociopath bullies that you see pop up in a lot of these movies, it kind of kills that little bit of momentum for me because I'm thinking, okay, I'm following around these kids. Everything feels so real. And I mean, and don't get me wrong. We all grew up with bullies and some of them probably grew up to be psychopaths, but man, the level of like murderous assholes,
the villainy it's just out of place,
right?
And I know that there's it's sort of explained in the mythology that Pennywise, his very presence has a corrosive effect on the town and the people in it, and it, while it's it brings out the worst in people and also makes them forget, history. So they look the other way when these kids start disappearing every 27 years. So, I mean, I understand, you know, that, yes, okay, well, the Pennywise's presence could cause a bullying situation to escalate to, like, some kind of psychopathic level like that. But, you know, it's I think I've seen too many Stephen King adaptations to have that be something that I really value anymore, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense. And, yeah, they do kind of, put that little disclaimer that they're like, oh yeah, and by the way, just in case you're like questioning anything in this movie, also Pennywise being there, it just changes everyone's mind and you're like, really? Like, I don't know, but I'm not gonna bitch about little mechanics. It's a movie. If we solved all these problems, then we wouldn't have movies. We would just have, like, let's go watch a logical handling of a situation on a large screen, you know? So I definitely get that.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm really interested to see who the adult actors are going to be to play the later in life characters that the kids are in this movie. Because I think anyone who's listening to this probably already knows that they broke up the book and to completely focus on the kids in the first one, and then they'll completely focus on the adults in the second one, and that's in the works. So it's really going to be interesting to see how they handle the adult versions of the characters, because the children were so well drawn.
Absolutely, and let's be annoying little internet people here for a minute and speculate. I don't know if you remember watching that second part of the miniseries, but it's incredibly boring.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
yeah, it really is. It's just terrible.
That second half, because I don't want to knock, because yeah, it's made for TV. It was made in the 90s. You know, it has all that. But that second half is like absolute snoozeville. Do you think, I guess you got to get a compelling enough cast, but is the second half of that story going to be, I mean, is it going to be like an embarrassing kind of follow up to this? I mean, do you think it's going to, I'm from the side, I think if you get a compelling cast and I enjoy being there for that part of the story, it could be great. But don't you feel like when you have something like this, doing that follow up, God, they gotta be scared to death.
Well, I certainly hope they don't fall for the same trap as the miniseries did, which is just this cheesy, melodramatic, it's like an adult situation that was written by a child, and like adult problems as seen through a child's perspective. It was just, it's just very clanging and uninteresting, to tell you the truth. I mean, I don't know. I think I think the director, Machete, is going to be, I trust him to maybe file down some of those annoying edges. But, that's right. It's definitely, if they have the miniseries as the warning against what not to do. So hopefully they'll know, and they'll be able to kind of avoid those pitfalls.
No, absolutely. So I'm sure you'll turn out great. I just had to at least ask about that. But I mean, but Chris, because I'm going to admit right now, I've read maybe like two or three, Stephen King books, and there were, classics like The Shining and Carrie, and I know I read one other offshoot, but have you ever read or listened to books on anything with the source material for It? I just have very limited knowledge on that.
Not for It. I read several Stephen King books. One of the very first one I read was Pet Sematary, and it scared the crap out of me. And then I watched the movie, and that scared the crap out of me. And then I think the second one that I read was The Stand, and that was a great book. But still, it has a lot of the fluff that you get with Stephen King books, and the dialogue that is just stilted and unrealistic and kind of annoying. I don't know if I minded that as much when I was reading them back when I was 13. But I did try to go back and reread Pet Sematary about a couple years ago, just to see how it was, because I remember it being such a big book in my younger life. And it's just cloying. The dialogue is just kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just very annoying. You know, people don't talk like that, and it's just it just kind of takes you out of the narrative flow. There's, you know, I think the Stephen King was doing a lot of drugs during this. I mean, admittedly, by him doing a lot of drugs during this time frame, and it just, you could just tell, like, you know, he writes himself into a place where he just all of a sudden, like, loses his mind and comes up with you know, just ridiculous things, like the child orgy in It, which obviously I haven't read, but is just an incredible addition to put into a book like that. And, you know, I believe in, you know, artists having freedom to explore even, like, you know, the taboo subjects and all that kind of stuff. But there's just nothing redemptive about putting a middle school orgy scene into any kind of book or movie or anything. And thank goodness they decided to not include that in the movie.
Yeah. And see, that was the weirdest thing with this release. Like, I've never seen more people, you know, grown people concerned to see and arguing over whether or not there needs to be a group sex scene among, you know, late middle school, early high school kids. Because, yeah, I mean, I've heard him go back and forth, you know, over the years, and everyone always, you know, your buddies who actually read books are always telling you about the shit that gets left out. And, yeah, so, I mean, I'll admit, when I was going to the movies, I was like, man, I've always heard about this scene. Like, is it going to be in this? And I don't think that would have done anything, especially with, you know, as you see towards the end, when they all make their bond, there doesn't need to be much more explained to you on screen from that side. Yeah, but
and it doesn't make any sense. It just, you know, the explanation and the justification for it from Stephen King is that this was Beverly's way of bringing everyone back together. Well, that's a crazy statement. absolutely crazy statement, and doesn't make any sense. And I mean, there's just, so, you know, I'm glad that it was there for us to talk about, and it was really funny seeing the one guy that we talked to after the movie while we were, you know, walking to our car. That was the thing he brought up. Well, you know, they didn't have the orgy scene, so that's good.
Right. Yeah, it's like, what a creepy topic to be on the tongues of every young adult American that went and saw that movie that weekend.
Yeah, that's right.
But, yeah, I mean, the great thing about it is, though, is with the huge, because I know I mentioned this before, but I mean, this was incredibly successful. What, it was the highest grossing R-rated film of all time, I believe. I could be mixing that up.
No, I think it surpassed Deadpool.
Yeah, I believe so. And the awesome part about that is, man, this is like a relatively, you know, kind of mid-budgeted film. It was violent, over the top, very mature and very adult, and it made a ton of money. And as we know, that catches the eyes of these studios, so hopefully we're going to keep getting these sorts of, like, kind of adult horror content coming out, because that's important. I mean, it's one thing for, like, you know, these PG-13, you know, horror movies, which are fine, they serve their purpose, they're geared towards a specific group. Yeah, that's great when that makes a ton of money, but it's so amazing when these types of titles come out that are strictly made for an adult, you know, for an adult audience. It's not pulling any punches. They're not, you know, self-censoring or shying away from gore to show that, like, hey, see what? If you make a good movie with all this stuff in it, it's going to make money. So hopefully we see that, you know, Hollywood continue that as they're looking for more content like this. And I mean, we saw with the release of Mother, you know, about a month ago, right after, you know, that was a studio that even said, hey, we tried something adult and crazy and strange, even though it failed, but we're going to keep continuing to do that. So I like seeing that there is, you know, a model moving forward for, you know, mature horror films.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the hope that, you know, that Hollywood will understand that there's, you don't need to make everything PG-13 to try to get the teenagers to come in and see your movie, that you can target an older, more mature audience and still make a lot of money. And I think that's great. I hope that, you know, we continue to get movies like this, because this was just a ton of fun. And I really can't wait to watch it again.
Oh, yeah. Same here. man, hopefully it's as fast as movies make it to video on demand. I'm ready to add that to our group Vudu account.
That's right.
That we all share here between my family and yours. So we'll be having that on there, and I'm sure that'll probably add to my normal Hollywood viewing every year. But in hopes to not beat this dead horse too much, Chris, we are getting ready to start our top five. List for this week right after the break. What are we going to be talking about?
Right. So because it is an obvious jumping off point from talking about it is to talk about our favorite Stephen King adaptations. So we each put together a list of our top five, and they're all movies, but you know, we weren't going to limit to just movies. They could have been miniseries or something like that. But I really am excited to talk about these movies. Going through, you realize just how many adaptations there are from Stephen King novels or novellas or short stories. And there are some great ones out there.
Oh, yeah, there are great ones. And there is also Langoliers to discuss. So we'll be coming back here in just a moment after the break. And we're going to lead in with our special guest, my son, Mac, Chris's stepson as well, to talk about a movie he loves. So we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back, everybody. We are here right now with my son, Chris's stepson, Mac McLaren, and he wanted to give a quick suggestion for your Halloween viewing. Mac, what movie did you want to suggest to everybody this week for their Halloween movie?
Happy Death Day.
Happy Death Day. Yeah, we went and saw that together just a few weeks ago, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell me a little bit. What did you like about it, man?
I like about with this song and when she keeps dying and there was a song coming.
Yeah, because when she keeps dying, you enjoyed that montage, didn't you, when they kept showing all the different ways? And what was it about the movie that you think would be like a good match for someone looking to watch something during Halloween and getting into the spooky season?
With that Siri mask scene.
The mask that the killer wears? So you think that was pretty good and pretty creepy? What else in there? Do you feel like the scenes were like spooky enough to kind of get people good and scared, but funny enough to kind of make it a good time going out on a Friday night?
Yes.
And tell me, Mac, did you even like that love story that was in that movie?
Kind of.
What do you think? Do you think it needed more of a love story or more kills?
More kills.
What was your favorite kill of the whole movie?
When she was spying on somebody, then a killer just... the killer just jumped, and she landed in the pool.
Yes, no, that was a good one. Well, you heard it first. That was Mac's suggestion for your Halloween viewing this year. So if you're going to go watch something spooky, go to the cinema, go see Happy Death Day. I did want to add to that I didn't get a chance to see it as well. And holy cow, I was blown away. I did not expect to be very much. I thought it was just going to be kind of a silly, I don't know what the word for it is, kind of loose-noodled sort of slasher film, you know, with the PG-13 rating, and instead it turned out to be kind of a sweet and adorable comedy with, you know, that kind of took place within a horror movie. So, yeah, no, I definitely second that opinion. So, with all that said, hey, Chris, we'll hop right into the list. What is your number five for your top five Stephen King adaptations?
All right, so my number five for me is Stand By Me, which is, and I don't know if you've seen this before, but it's a really well done, I haven't read the book, but it's a really well done adaptation. And, you know, it's a Rob Reiner movie from 1986. It basically is about this group of friends that they find a body of a missing boy. And it's just very immersive and well acted and well directed. And, you know, I haven't seen it in a long time, and I was meaning to get at least one viewing in before we talked about it, so I'd have it a little bit more like on, you know, on the top of my mind. But I remember growing up and thinking just how it was, you know, it moved me emotionally even when I saw it when I was about like 8 or 9 years old. You know, just it's kind of a small story, but it has a lot of like large themes of like the meaning of friendship and the need to like stand up for what's right and that kind of thing. And it's just a really well done movie.
Oh yeah, because that's a movie that I haven't, like, I'm with you, I haven't seen it for a long time, but it had a huge impact on me when I was a kid. I probably saw it around the age of, I don't know, probably 9 or 10, kind of, you know, close to the ages of all the kids that were in the movie. And I remember it being like, in my brain, it was like the serious version of the Goonies. It was like,
that's right.
These
that's
kids
right.
with these real problems and these, and this, you know, very kind of real world, you know, kind of a take to what's essentially kids going on this adventure. So I was like, oh man, this is gonna be like Goonies, you know. And I'm looking at all the actors in there, and oh, then I watched it, I'm like, oh man, this is like heavy shit that these kids are dealing with. But yeah, no, that is a fantastic movie, and I do need to revisit it. I wanted to put it on my list, but it just been so long since I took the time to watch it. Yeah, my number five is not only a Stephen King adaptation, but Stephen King himself's directorial debut, Maximum Overdrive. That is a movie that I think a lot of us grew up watching. It played all the time on TV, especially on like TBS and TNT and those sorts of channels. And it is batshit crazy. Even Stephen King himself said that he was just coked out of his mind. They asked him to direct a movie, and this was the, you know, the silliness that he ended up coming up with during that kind of drug fueled haze. But in the midst of it being this silly story, it's actually a lot of fun, and I think it's perfect for like that sort of age range that when it came out, because if you're not familiar with it, it's basically a movie about Emilio Estevez. He is saving the world from all these inanimate objects that somehow, through whatever fake science in the film, all of the cars, you know, electrical dryers, everything to vending machines, has turned against man and became sentient and starts attacking humans. They're basically going through the tail of a comet, and this small little group ends up getting kind of holed up and has to be able to survive, you know, this brief amount of time that they're stuck going through the tail of the comet. But it's got a really amazing soundtrack, I guess, with AC/DC playing the whole time. I don't know if you remember that, Chris.
I do. Yeah, no, I love the soundtrack. It was great.
Yeah, and it is just so 90s. It's so hodgepodge. But there's also like one of my favorite kills ever when you first kind of see the what's known as, you know, the Green Goblin truck, when it flies through and it hits people, it's just these awesome, like, weird, you know, like, you definitely tell that they're hitting, you know, that they're hitting dummies out there, but just the way the blood comes off of them and everything like that is just, like, such a fun kill. And then, you know, you just go through, like, you know, like, similar to what my son mentioned before with the montages, there is a montage of just mayhem that happens probably about 15 or 20 minutes into the film that I just absolutely love. Towards the end, it does get a little bit grueling after they kind of settle into the final location. But I think it's one of those movies that if you're bored on a Saturday, you want to fold a bunch of clothes and just have something fun playing on in the background, I definitely suggest, you know, revisiting Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, you know, and Emilio Estevez, I mean, what a run he had in the 80s and 90s, right? I mean, I remember watching the Maximum Overdrive because it had Emilio Estevez in it, and I was a big fan of his.
Yeah.
You know, Young Guns was huge for me. Stakeout, I remember, you know, Stakeout, just like, loved Stakeout. I saw it with my grandmother, and I remember just thinking that was the funniest movie I had ever seen for some reason. And then, of course, you know, Men at Work, which is just a classic. I love that movie. Loaded Weapon. I forgot he was in Loaded Weapon. That's right. He was in the spoof. And then Judgment Night, which is great.
Oh, yeah. It, I don't know if you ever saw this, but are you familiar with the trailer for Maximum Overdrive?
I don't think I've seen it. I may have, but I definitely don't remember.
Well, Chris and everybody else that's listening, take a few minutes out of your day, put in the YouTube Maximum Overdrive theatrical trailer. It is one of the best things ever. It is a very unenthusiastic, borderline annoyed Stephen King trying to verbally sell you on his new movie. It is absolutely awesome. He's like, "Hi, this is Master of Horror Stephen King," and this is, and it is just, it's incredibly of that time, kind of that crossover between the 80s and 90s, where, you know, people are trying out new things, but they're corny as shit, and nobody's telling them. But yeah, it is an awesome trailer. But Chris, what do you got for your number four?
Okay, so my number four is the Shawshank Redemption, which, you know, for the longest time I did not realize was based on a Stephen King story. It is, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's kind of like The Green Mile in that way, where there's not a lot of classic Stephen King tropes to it. It's just a thoughtful, emotional drama. Set in a prison. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's about a character named Andy Dufresne who gets sent to prison for a crime that he didn't commit, and it really is about his redemption arc as a person, it's really about the idea of hope and the ability of someone to hold on to hope even in the darkest, most like brutal situations possible, and to come out on the other side as with victory and with redemption. I'm sure you've seen it as well. I think everyone has probably seen this movie, but it really is it's a great rewatch. I haven't seen it in probably a couple of years, but every once in a while I'll catch it on cable and I'll sit down and I'll just start watching it again. It's just one of those movies that kind of sticks with you and has grown larger over time.
Oh yeah, and I'm guilty of this, where the Shawshank Redemption is inarguably a great movie. It's a lot of fun. It's this epic story, but the amount that I've seen it has totally jaded me on it for some reason, where I acknowledge, I'm like, yeah, it's a good movie, I'm never watching it again. But then I sit down and I start to watch it and I get sucked in and I forget that I'm not an asshole all the time and I can enjoy this kind of uplifting, nice movie. Because I don't know, like, it's one of those, it's kind of like movies like Fight Club, where I get so worn out on, you know, people tell me, "Oh man, I love Fight Club, where I start thinking, I don't think I like Fight Club. Then I watch it again, I'm like, no, I do like it. I just get sick of being told how great it is all the time. So that's one of those movies that, unfortunately, it's just the conversation and the amount of times that I've seen it or had to talk about it to people, it kind of soured me on it. But that is only because I'm an asshole and nice things. Because it really is a good movie.
It's funny that you say that, because when I was building my list, I kept on wanting to talk my way out of adding Shawshank Redemption, because one, it was so obvious. And also that, yeah, it's been seen and talked about so much that there's really not much more interesting things to say about it. But going through all the different movies, it just kept on kind of sticking in my mind, like, no, this should be on my list, because it really is a great movie that I really enjoyed and still really do enjoy.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you included it, because my own sour personality, I kept thinking in my head, well, that is one of the best adaptations, but I just don't want to bring it up. So I'm so glad that you did, because I think that our list would kind of be bullshit if we didn't include that, because it's well deserving of that spot. And also, to people like me that aren't big Stephen King readers, I love seeing his non-horror and some of his other, you know, attempts. So yeah, no, it's a fantastic movie and definitely deserves to be on that list. And I'm sure, just turn on like TNT and it's on right now.
That's right. I'm sure it is. You know, and it's, you know, and I just, before we stop talking about it, I do want to point out that it has just absolutely great turns by two actors, Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins, just knock it out of the park. I think it's arguably the best roles of both of their careers. They're just so believable in the roles and so well developed and thought out. So I would be remiss if I didn't point out that they really are something else in this movie.
Oh no, those two, they knock it out of the park. They show why they are, you know, a couple of Hollywood's greats. Because man, just the entire like epic nature of seeing these men go from, you know, being, you know what, like probably starting around their early to mid 30s all the way through life. It's a lot of fun to watch and, you know, and actually see something that kind of explores the better side of human nature. My number four is a little bit more along the lines of classic Stephen King, but I would have to include a movie that I grew up loving, especially with all the TV movie adaptations, is 1979's Tobe Hooper directed film Salem's Lot. This was the movie that I saw. I didn't know anything about who Stephen King was or wasn't. Caught it on, I believe it was either ABC or CBS. Scared the ever loving shit out of me. Just seeing that, you know, these people basically moving to this small, nearly abandoned town, and then having just these monstrous vampires creeping up through the nights. And I grew up, you know, watching a lot of Universal movies. My idea of Dracula was always, you know, kind of the European debonair, you know, cape-wearing type. Then all of a sudden I was watching this movie where the vampires were these just hideous, disgusting monsters that come up in the middle of the night, and like they're actual beasts rather than, you know, what I was used to. Did you catch this one, Chris?
You know, I don't think so. If I did, it was a long time ago, but I don't really have any memory of watching it. And when you put it on your list, I went back and tried to, you know, look it up on the internet and try to figure out, you know, if I had seen it. But it looks great. I was reading some reviews about it, and it's got pretty good reviews. And after hearing you talk about it, I want to make sure that it gets on my list.
Oh yeah, because I think you're definitely gonna love it, because it is definitely, it's towards the end of that cycle of really good TV movies where it didn't feel quite as cheap or throwaway. Maybe it's just because they were still shooting on 35mm. But it looks, I mean, it's just as well as a standalone movie now. And also with the recent passing of Tobe Hooper, I wanted to make sure to include, because I think this is one of the titles that people kind of overlook when you're talking about, you know, things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist, Invader from Mars. I think a lot of people kind of sleep on the fact that he also made this really great, like, 3-hour miniseries on one of Stephen King's, you know, most well-known titles. But hey, Chris, what'd you have for your next? You're number three.
All right, so my number three is The Running Man.
Yeah, it
has also made your list, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is my number three as well. And oh man, you kick us off.
Okay, so yeah, so just to kind of give you a little synopsis, this is an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie directed by Paul Michael Glazer. And it's set in 2017, oddly enough, and it's it concerns a wrongly convicted police officer in Schwarzenegger's character, who gets put into a TV show execution. There's the most popular show in this dystopic world is this show called The Running Man, where criminals get put into this elaborate kind of arena and then just get hunted down and killed and all for the popular enjoyment. And it's just it's over the top. It's violent. It's great. It's a classic Schwarzenegger movie. And I love this movie. I really do.
Oh yeah. No, this is a movie. Like I said, this is my number three as well. And I love these types of movies. I always love these sorts of, you know, battles or games based around, you know, survival. And if you kill this person, you get these points and everything like that. So when I was a kid, this was like ripe for me. I grew up loving Death Race 2000, movies like death machines and that, that. And it's definitely one of the more exploitation kind of films that Arnold Schwarzenegger did. And I know that a lot of people complain that, I guess, it leaves out a lot of the social, you know, and everything like that, that was originally in the book. But I absolutely love it. I love Arnold Schwarzenegger coming in there, you know, because I guess he's wrongfully accused of basically a huge massacre, right?
Like hundreds of unarmed civilians. That's right.
Like hundreds, just mowing down hundreds of unarmed civilians during what they're calling a food riot, because, you know, of course, this future, they're only giving you entertainment, not food or anything of actual value. And oh man, I love once they get into the film when he's facing off against Sub-Zero. You've got Yaphet Kotto in this flick, who I love seeing. Richard Dawson, a lot of fun. And although I haven't seen a whole lot from Glazier, it kind of makes me curious to kind of go back through his repertoire and see what else he made, because I watched this movie probably about 3 months ago, and it's still played really well.
Yeah, it's just so rewatchable. It really is. And you're right about it. It just completely discards all the social commentary in favor of this kind of parody of an exploitation action movie. And it doesn't take itself too seriously. It's there to be fun, and it really is.
Yeah, no, it's a blast. It's a big dumb 80s action movie that definitely, it's definitely not as good as, say, like Terminator or The Predator. Oh, but it's pretty damn close, if you ask me.
Yeah, that's right. It's right up there in terms of classic Schwarzenegger movies. That's for sure.
Okay, well, with your, since we agreed on number three, I believe our number twos are actually different. What was yours, Chris?
Yeah, so my number two is The Dead Zone, classic Cronenberg movie starring Christopher Walken, Brooke Adams, and Tom Skerritt. And have you seen this movie?
Oh my gosh, yes. And when we first did our list and kind of exchanged them back and forth, kind of a little bit of inside baseball here, I totally forgot that was Stephen King. Like, I always think of that more as a Cronenberg movie. And when I saw it on your list, I was so jealous because I didn't even think of it. But yeah, that is, it's a movie I haven't seen for a while. And I got a chance to kind of revisit it here over the last couple weeks. And holy shit, Christopher Walken is so good in that movie.
Oh, this might be my favorite. I love Christopher Walken and everything. I mean, you can't beat him in Pulp Fiction and, you know, and basically anything he's ever been in. But this movie, you know, it stands out. I had a Cronenberg phase where I went and I watched all the Cronenberg movies, you know, and just really got into it. You know, Videodrome, this one, Scanners, you know, just all of the different movies that he, you know, he made famous for his attention to body horror and that kind of thing. And this one is, it's about it's a teacher who goes into a coma after a really terrible accident. He's in a coma for 5 years. He wakes up and he discovers that he has this ability to see the past, present, and future of other people's lives if he comes into physical contact with them. And he finds that, you know, this gift or this ability comes with a high cost, because it's, you're seeing the people's deaths often, you know, the visions that he has are frightening, and even apocalyptic, you know, towards the end. And it's I think it's just a really strong movie that holds up. You know, it doesn't, even now, if you go back and watch it, it's interesting from the very get go. It has this mood and this rhythm to it that's just put you on edge, and it's carried through by Christopher Walken's performance. And I can't recommend this highly enough.
Yeah, and I remember a few years back, it was on one of those basic cable stations. But did you ever watch the TV show that was on for a while?
No, I never did, and I don't really know why, because I was such a big fan of this movie that anything about in this universe probably would have roped me in. I think it just kind of passed me by without me knowing about it.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same. That's why I was asking, because I was always in the same boat. I'd always see commercials for it, and I'd be like, oh, that's so rad. I didn't realize there's a TV show. Then I would just never watch it. I know it ran for probably 6 or 7 seasons, but yeah, there's no denying. Yeah, because, I mean, one thing I like about going through this list is seeing all of these amazing directors that somewhere along the along their career have had to, you know, kind of face off with some Stephen King material, almost like, you know, like a boss on a video game here. But my number two is another great filmmaker from this era. I'm talking about Brian De Palma's Carrie, directed and it released in 1976. This is a movie that I think is probably solidly in my top 25 of all time. You know, seeing a film come from Brian De Palma during this era, they're all pretty fucking fantastic. But seeing him move over into a fully realized, you know, paranormal thriller, you know, true blue horror film, him pulling out these fantastic, you know, these fantastic performances out of Sissy Spacek, seeing a John Travolta who seemingly gave a shit about acting at that time, and just these soft, beautiful shots towards the beginning and moving into some of the most brutal filmmaking towards the end. Chris, what's kind of your relationship with Carrie?
Well, I've actually seen it several times, and was deeply disturbed by it. Obviously, I think that there's just something about, you know, Sissy Spacek's, her commitment to the character, it feels almost too real to make me, you know, to be comfortable with it in certain places. And, you know, it sticks with you. I don't even know how to put my finger on exactly what it is about the movie that makes it stick with you. But, you know, you can't get it out of your mind once you see it.
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely sticks with you. And everyone always kind of remembers, you know, remembers their first experience with this movie, because there's so much there. It's quotable. It's crafted to me, it's always felt like if Alfred Hitchcock got to make the movies as dirty and as raw as he always wanted to, I always felt like this is the film he probably would have made. And, you know, you look at also, you know, other people in this supporting cast, when you have, you know, PJ Souls and Piper Loris, oh my gosh, all these characters. And when you think of those great horror villains, I just don't think there's a better one than Piper Laurie's, you know, role as her mother in that film.
Yeah, she's really frightening as her mother. I mean, when she's, you know, comforting her, and then she just stabs her in the back. like, what? I mean, just wow, you know? And then, and that death, her death scene is just amazing, where she's crucified by the kitchen utensils.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's just, and then, of course, that's when Carrie loses, you know, control and, you know, burns down the house. And, I mean, it really is. It's just a frightening movie. You know, it's to have the mother at being that kind of villain, and you know, it scared the shit out of me when I was growing up.
Yeah, I agree, man. It's such an uncomfortable movie as well. You know, just seeing this woman coming into her own, being fully abused by her psychotic mother, and in the end, when we should kind of be feeling good at the revenge that Carrie's finally getting against her classmates and her mother, it's still just so tragic and sad. And one thing that we have to give credit to this movie is creating the whole, is, you know, the monster's not dead kind of stinger ending. And something that has always driven me nuts about this movie, it totally doesn't need it, but I don't know if that's ever bugged you at all, Chris.
Oh, the ending?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just completely unnecessary. You don't need to have her waking up from the nightmare. And the, I mean, it's just, you know, I think it's the movie itself is so strong that it was really just kind of a misfire.
It really is. I hate that last kind of stinger ending. It always reminds me of also, like, you know, the added ending of Nightmare on Elm Street when the mother gets sucked into the into the closet. It just reminds me of
that. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so it always kind of reminded me of that. But overall, there's tons and tons to say about Carrie that's been said before. I did get an opportunity last year to see it on 35mm in a movie theater with a crowd. And also, before they showed the film, our local burlesque group, Blast Off Burlesque, did a fantastic, like, 20-minute rendition that was so bloody, so awesome and disgusting that it really, you know, just reminded me how much fun that movie is. So that said, Chris, get us to both of our number ones, a movie that I think is both in, you know, our top films of all time. What is it, Chris?
Yeah, and well, that's right. It is in my top. It's one of my favorite movies. It's one of the most astounding movies that you'll watch. Deeply unsettling, with great performances and obviously a great genius director. It's The Shining by Stanley Kubrick.
Yep. There's not much to say. It's one of the great horror films, one of the great films of all time. You know, probably in my top three of Stanley Kubrick films. But Chris, what made you put this as your number one?
It really is the feeling that you get from watching it. I mean, you know, I think I use the word atmospheric probably too much, but the atmospheric qualities of this movie, the slow dread that creeps in from every corner of the frame, the falling apart of the main character Jack Torrance slowly into insanity, you know, as he's trying to work on his book while taking his family to be like the property managers basically of this hotel while it's closed down for the winter, and you know there's just so many different scenes that are nightmare inducing. They're not classic jump scenes. It's just the subject matter itself that is so disturbing. I mean, the twin girls, just how creepy they are, showing up in the hotel, and talking to Danny. The scene that always got me was the bathtub scene where, you know, he comes into that room, where the murders allegedly took place, and he sees a beautiful young woman taking a bath, and then he goes to kiss her, and she turns into this decrepit, decaying, dead older lady. There's just something about that. It just kills me. Like every time, like it just makes me, it's disgusting. It's disturbing. And there's just, the whole movie is filled with that. And, you know, it starts out with like the horror is all basically supernatural. And then it just gets incorporated into Jack Torrance, and then he becomes the murdering husband who's trying to track down his wife and son and kill them. And it's just a top to bottom, just a great movie to watch on Halloween. I really can't wait to let the boys see it, because it's it's unlike anything else that you'll ever see. There's just, I can't imagine it being remade or put into a different director's hands or have different actors in those roles. Even Shelley Duvall, who, you know, I think gets a bad rap and is definitely not one of my favorite actresses of all time. You know, even her role in this movie, she does such a great job of this. She's such an eminently decent person who wants to see the best in everything. And then her slow realization that her husband is a psychotic. And then, you know, her having to take, you know, really big steps to protect herself and her son. There's so many different parts of this movie that I could talk about it literally for hours and hours. It's that good.
No, there's no denying it. This is one of my favorite films of all time. Every single year. See, I always keep this movie for some reason. I got to wait until it's like, it's the real winter. It's cold outside. And, you know, I'll pop in the movie about 10 o'clock at night, just enjoy those first few like cold nights of the year and watch this. And it is still, maybe in my opinion, the scariest film of all time, because a lot of what happens still bugs me to this day. It still makes me want to turn on the lights before I walk in the rooms, just like when I saw it the first time at around the age 11. And I don't know if I've ever told this story on this podcast before, but this is one of the first films that like really got me into horror films. We were at a Bible study that my parents would go to when we were kids, and they would put all the kids in this other room and just like just watch TV, play, and just let us do our thing. And as a group, we were flipping through channels. We found, we're probably 20 minutes into the movie, we found the Shining, and me with a group of kids that weren't even allowed to watch, you know, like Smurfs, let alone the fucking Shining, sat down all scarred for life. I remember for months on end, I was so afraid to get out of my bed in the middle of the night. I think I even ended up peeing in a cup one night because I was so afraid that if I opened the door in my room, I was going to see those two creepy twins staring back at me. And to this day when I watch it, it still plays with my brain that way. Because like you were saying, it's not these jump scares. It's this overall building of dread and fear. And you just you feel how dangerous he's becoming. You feel this huge empty structure just taking over this man who seems a little unhinged to begin with, and you just don't know what he's going to do next. So when you're seeing him bust through the house and watching him unravel, there is this feeling of anything could happen. And I think if anyone's ever been, especially in like a large structure where nobody else is there, that is a terrifying feeling of just, what if somebody was in here? What if there was some other force? And like you said, with that scene when with the naked woman who turns into, the old bloated dead thing, those are nightmare inducing, not only as a kid, but as an adult. And I still, you're getting through the final scenes, when you see the proto furry in one of those rooms.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
That is so disturbing.
The glimpses of the horror that exists behind closed doors, it really stuck with me. The idea that when something unspeakable happens in a place, that there's an element that stays with, or like a, some kind of like spirit anomaly that stays with the place and that can lead to a recurrence. The little kid just growling red rum. I mean, that still gets me every time. I think that it's kind of astounding how much of an impact it has. But when Wendy finds the stack of paper for the manuscript for his novel, and it's just hundreds of pages with the line "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy" written over and over and over again. It shouldn't work as well as it does because it's kind of a simple thing, but it really is. Like all of a sudden, like you just like, oh my gosh, only a crazy person would have done that. And then you realize that she and Danny are stuck in this place with a crazy person. That he now become, he's just unknowable now, and that unknowability is frightening.
Yeah, and with you mentioning like the all sleep, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, and all those sorts of things. This movie is amazing because in all of kind of like the zeitgeist things that everybody knows from the movie, that here's Johnny, and the all work and no play, and all the kind of quotables from the film, it doesn't take away from it when you watch it in context. It doesn't, it kind of rises above that, and you see it and you're like, holy shit, this is still scary. Even though I have all this kind of, knowledge, I usually kind of, can kind of play with older films, it's still scary as hell. But yeah, I feel like this is one of the greatest horror films of all time. Definitely the best adaptation that I've ever seen. But yeah, there's not much better.
Jack Nicholson, I mean, his face, the way that he plays Jack Torrance, the way that his whole demeanor starts to slacken and to become like wild and unruly. It's just a phenomenal performance. I was researching this, Kubrick had originally wanted either Robert De Niro or Robin Williams to be the role of Jack Torrance. And allegedly, according to the internet, he thought that Robert De Niro wasn't psychotic enough and that Robin Williams was too psychotic to be in the role. And then right before they started filming, Stanley Kubrick, who's one of his favorite films was Eraserhead by David Lynch, he actually sat down and made the entire cast and crew watch Eraserhead prior to filming this movie to get them in the mood.
Wow. See, I've never heard that part. That makes a lot of sense because it does kind of have that same sort of weird dread feeling. The same thing that makes me love the shit out of Eraserhead. I mean, it has that same like kind of tone where it's not jumping out and scare you. It's like haunting your subconscious, kind of scary.
Yeah, that's right. It's all psychological, and that's why I think even though you know what's going to happen, and you know everything has entered the zeitgeist and the popular imagination, and there's just no getting away from the here's Johnny and that kind of thing. The scary part is not twists and it's not jumps. It's psychological, and so you can revisit it over and over again because that's kind of, you know, once you allow the movie to kind of hypnotize you and immerse you into the story, then you start kind of having those psychological effects play on you over and over and over again.
You are 100% right, and I'm going to be tossing on this on The Shining tonight.
Yeah, like right now, right? I'm going to with this podcast. I'm going to go watch it again.
Yeah, let's just cut the podcast and go watch Shining right now. All right, folks, we'll be back in a minute and let you know what's coming up next.
Well, Blaine, again, this has been a lot of fun. I just enjoyed all of these movies that we talked about. I really can't wait to see Salem's Lot. I really can't wait to see The Shining again. And I think I'll probably end up, now that I've talked about it, going back and watching The Dead Zone, maybe even getting The Running Man up on the TV, too. But anyways, it's been a lot of fun. I know that we have another episode planned out. And can you go ahead and describe for the audience what that's going to be?
Yes, next episode coming up, we're going to be covering Blade Runner 2049 as well as our top five films from Denny Villeneuve, however you pronounce it. We'll just be saying our top five by Denny coming up here soon. So, yeah, tune in next time. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. Make sure to be rating and responding, and just let us know what you think out there.
That's right. And again, thank you guys for listening. We can't wait to get back on the podcast and talk about movies by Denny.
We'll be back here soon. So everybody, until then, have a good day, a happy Halloween, and peace.